coming to this 15th anniversary of the Coalition on Political Assassinations Regional Meeting in Dallas. We do this meeting every year. We have since 94. And on the fifth year anniversaries, which last year was one, we also do Memphis and Los Angeles for Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And the last 3 years, and next year, which will be the 45th anniversary of that assassination, we are going to be in New York again at the Dr. Betty Shabazz and Malcolm X Memorial and Educational Center with a panel about Malcolm X's assassination. So we try to cover the major political assassinations of the 60s. We keep pushing for release of files and release of the history. COPA began some time ago as an effort to gather the research community together, to work on projects together, to oversee the release of the JFK assassination files under the JFK Records Assassination Act, and we had some impact on that. And we're also currently working on what we hope will be an introduction finally this year of a new Martin Luther King Records Act that will release the files on the life and death of Dr. King. And we have two people in the key subcommittee and committee posts who are former members of the Congressional Black Caucus and were co-sponsors when it was introduced under Cynthia McKinney when I worked for her, and both of them want to get the bill moving. So when you have the two chairs, there's a good chance you'll get a hearing. And so we're along. We don't have a number yet. We've got the right people working on it, and it potentially could release hundreds of thousands of records regarding Dr. King. The House Select Committee on Assassination Records on JFK are for the most part released, but not the pages, hundreds of thousands of pages on Dr. King, and there are many other records that relate to that assassination. And we keep pushing at these conferences to get each year the best new evidence, new research, forensic and ballistic medical evidence, and the authors that are doing the good work. And we've got a great lineup this year. We're going to be here tonight. The rest of the weekend we are at the Hotel Lawrence, over at the corner of Houston and Jackson Streets, just down from Dealey Plaza. But we traditionally have come to the Adolphus for the keynote speech, and we did that tonight. If you're here and looking for a restroom, it's straight to the back and all the way to the right. If you're looking for a good lecture, you found one. We have a full registration as well as a day registration, so you can maybe be coming to this event, maybe you just want to come to one other day, and hopefully you can do that. And we this year also commemorated a talk, which we do annually in Washington, D.C. on June the 6th. It was given in 1963 by President Kennedy regarding the end of the Cold War and the end of the arms race, and putting himself pretty much at odds with the military-industrial complex to go on at that point. And we go to the place where he gave it to American U and commemorate that. We have a lineup, and it should have gotten a schedule outside if you didn't, but we have quite a few speakers going through tomorrow and into Sunday. In addition to that, we will be going out to the grassy knoll to do a moment of silence at 12:30 p.m., which we do annually. And we will that afternoon, for those that are interested, and maybe I could get a raise of hands here, people that are interested in going down to Waco, the Baylor University, the Pogue Political Library, where the Penn Jones collection and now other researchers' collections have begun to be stored. And Ben Rogers will talk to us about what's there. He's the curator on Sunday. But if people want to take that ride down and have a car that they'd be willing to carpool some of us down, I'm interested to find out who those people are and who wants to go before we hit Sunday. So please come and talk to me about that. And in addition to that, on Sunday night, if you happen still to be here at 8 o'clock, there's going to be a Discovery Channel special that we're going to watch in the restaurant off the lounge at the Hotel Lawrence. It goes two specials, one on JFK and the mob, and one on some new tapes about JFK. We don't expect it to be our quality of broadcast, but you know, we do look at to see how they're propagandizing and spinning.
I'm only watching if Gary Mack is the host.
All right. I'll tell him that. So we'll be watching that on Sunday night. And then I was invited on Monday night, if you're still in Dallas, to speak at the Dallas Peace Center. And my topic is, there must be some way out of here, the rise of the military industrial complex, the permanent war economy, and the future,
I think you're wrong, John.
And the future of humanity.
There is no
way out of here. But we'll see. I'll try to invent one. If you're lucky, there'll be a way out of this room. And I should say at the end also, Jim will be signing his book at the rear if people want to buy copies of his book, and that will be available when he, after he speaks. But that's pretty much the outline. We do have a resource in the book section at the Hotel Lawrence as well, care of and with the help of Andy Winarsik and Lester Obooks and Gerald Blow, who's here tonight. And so we have a mix of events, and we've been getting a little bit of mention. I think in large part, John Garrity's here. He's our web master and web person. He's also done social networking through Facebook and YouTube. And so we're starting to be seen by people that haven't seen us before, and some of you may be here because of that. And, you know, we're glad for that. Not that we're not glad to see all of our old friends as well, but, you know, we do want to get out beyond the choir, and so we're glad for the new people that are coming here. We got a little dishonorable mention by none other than Bruce Sterling, a sci-fi writer. Although I say he printed our entire schedule on his blog, but at the top he says, "What the heck kind of society have I lived long enough to see? It's like being live at the witch trials." I wrote and asked him what he had to do with witch trials. I said, "Were the witches convicted on ballistic evidence?" But even dishonorable mentions, sometimes if the person's important enough, you know. I got my dishonorable mention on John McLaughlin on when he said that that Mel Gibson in the movie Conspiracy Theory portrayed a jacked up programmed MKUltra assassin with a John Judge personality. So I said it gave a whole new meaning to conspiracy buff. Kennedy made the talk, and I think it's an important one, and fits into what Jim's addressing tonight, at American University in 63, a few months before he was killed. He said, "I've therefore chosen this time and this place to discuss the most important topic on earth, world peace. The United States will never start a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough of war and hate and oppression. Confident and unafraid, we labor on, not toward a strategy of annihilation, but toward a strategy of peace." And his aides said that it was probably one of the most important talks that he gave, and a number of them were enlisted to do that. He talked about having a realistic peace. He said, "What kind of peace do I mean? What kind of peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, or enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I'm talking about a genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and to build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women, and not merely peace in our time, but peace for all time." And now he understood very well that they were heading in a direction that could have annihilated life as we know it on the planet, and he was trying to get beyond that. And he said, "Let's not be blind to our differences, but let's direct our attention to common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we can't end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air, and we all cherish our children's future, and we're all mortal." So we do go out and commemorate that speech. As many of you know, there are quite a number of new books out on the market about Kennedy and the other assassinations. One interesting one that I invited Ron Goldfarb to come, even though he's written some things I don't like, but he wrote one on called In Confidence about secrecy, and he knows about the JFK Records Act and had written a chapter in that. But we had, in the last few years, Shane O'Sullivan's great work on Who Killed Bobby, a book and a movie. Michael Morrissey, a longtime researcher, wrote about his correspondence with Vince Salandri in one book, and Looking for the Enemy. Lyndon Barston's book, Truth at Last, came out about the King assassination. And Jeff Moore. morally created some stir and still is with our man in Mexico about Winston Scott and his current push now to get the records on Joannides. Michael Dobbs did an interesting book, 1 Minute to Midnight, about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And all of that, the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs, have been rewritten by the files that are released on by the Kennedy assassination. And many of these books are influenced by the release of those records. There's a new book out about RFK called The Last Campaign, and a book on Jim Garrison by Joe Mellon, Open and Shut Case, that we had those people present in Los Angeles, Dr. Robert Joling, a former head of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, Philip von Prague, an audio expert, because they found an actual tape recording of the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and it shows, as many of us knew for a long time, too many shots to have come from Sirhan's gun, probably 13 shots, and 5 from one and 8 from another. And it's hard physical evidence of what many of the researchers knew from the photographic and witness evidence, but this is a piece that they shouldn't be able to ignore, but these books come out, and it seems nothing much changes. Wesley Swearingen did To Kill a President. Abraham Bolden, who some people heard from today, wrote an echo from Dealey Plaza, and we're going to be able to add him to our agenda tomorrow afternoon, so he's going to come and speak at COVID, a slot that opened up. And also, of course, we've had the other side, anything from Reclaiming History, and when they saw what it was, another book they made him write called 4 Days in November that was greatly truncated. He had a longer book, I think, on the CD at the back than he had on the 1,000-page doorstopper he wrote in the front. But, we've had what I think are misleading books by Legacy of Secrecy, and some of the people you hear from, like Lisa Pease and Jim DiEugenio and others, have been critiquing them online and reviewing them for some time. But I just think there's so much out. The 13th Juror just came out, which is a transcript of the Martin Luther King civil rights trial, and very worth reading, Dr. Pepper's case, and there's books that continue to come. Malcolm Marable, who we're going to try to have up in New York next year, is about to finish a biography of Malcolm X, and I heard him speak, and he worked on the assassination and come to the same conclusions that the research community has. So we have trends that arise, and even the speaker tonight, we expect we'll have several more books about other political assassinations. We don't see them as separate things. We see them as part of a pattern and a design, and in some cases the same modus operandi and even the same operatives. To give you a small example, a medical examiner named Francesco in Memphis, who botched the King autopsy by not doing it, he said to honor the family, he wouldn't try to figure out the direction of the bullet, was invited. Luckily, Dr. Noguchi stepped in, but he was actually invited to come to Los Angeles and do the Robert Kennedy autopsy. But that's only one example of what I call, if it ain't broke, you don't fix it. Also, there's other new materials that are coming out in movies. I got one reading that there's some sort of a reading room project at the Sixth Floor Museum that was supposed to open this year. I don't know if it did or not. There's a lot of stuff at the Sixth Floor Museum that researchers have wanted to see but haven't been able to see. And I don't know if they'll put it in the reading room or not, but
yeah.
I could try to find out. Another person I invited to come was Antoinette Giancana, Giancana's daughter. I like comic relief once in a while.
Yeah.
She didn't like the idea, I guess.
Yeah.
Or else they're coming tonight, and I don't know it. There's a book called The Kennedy Assassination 24 Hours After, which is a study about the response immediately that has details in it. Just responses online to Bugliosi that I think are worth reading themselves.
Jim's
does, and I think Fonzi, and so that goes on. There's at least one surviving periodical, JFK Deep Politics Quarterly by Walt Brown. There used to be 3 or 4, but something comes out, but I think the internet has replaced this kind of thing with online newsletters and blogs. The guy who published the book of Ford's memoirs is suing to get JFK assassination files loose and trying to prove that Ford really, you know, thought that there was some kind of a conspiracy, and he's having trouble. Hundreds of photos were just released from the Dallas police through a case, and there's a new film out about Kennedy, asking, it was called Virtual JFK, Vietnam and Kennedy Had Lived. And it poses that idea. I tried to get them to show it here, but they wanted hundreds of dollars for the showing, so I said, well, you know, we can't do that. Another interesting movie this year that I think is pertinent was the release of Valkyrie, which is a very interesting plot to kill Hitler that involved invoking Hitler's continuity of government plan that would have come in when he was killed by somebody else and using it to blame the SS and take over that way. And I think that that's similar to the plotting of Operation Northwoods and some of the things and that some of the continuity of government plans were and have been still are being usurped by these people. So I think it's worth seeing just to get that idea. I get an online service called WikiLeaks. I don't know about them, but they cover political assassinations. And every day I also iGoogle, and you can get searches of documents on and different sources of information. Of course, now the best information seems to be outside the country, not inside. Another person I invited who couldn't come because of schedule was DA Craig Watkins, the new district attorney the last few years here in Dallas, first black district attorney here. And also fairly progressive. He found some documents in Henry Wade's safe and released them, and I thought he would be an interesting person to talk to and also to press for the opening of a grand jury in Dallas to reopen the Kennedy case. We continue to work on getting the files loose from JFK. We've got 6.5 million pages, more released each year, and we press for that. The Nazi War Crimes Records Act is the only other act that outdoes that. They've got over 8.5 million pages, but we'd like to see the King Act get put into place this year. And Bill Kelly, who many of you know, co-founder of COPA and the Committee for an Open Archive, has been pushing for oversight hearings on the JFK Act. My sense of Congress, having been inside it, is that it's not something they'll do in a vacuum and they don't have enough interest now, but if we can get hearings on Martin Luther King Act, it is based on the JFK Act, and through that we might be able, I think, to get some review of what was done or not done. Here's some deaths this year. An ex-FBI agent died. Maybe you read about this, but I found it pretty interesting, by the name of Ingram, Jim Ingram. Pancreatic cancer, 77-year-old retired agent. He worked with the Mississippi Highway Patrol, and he'd been in the agency quite some time. He invested Klan killings and violent acts in Mississippi regarding Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney. He worked on other cases, including the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the 1968 assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King, and the 1978 mass suicide in Guyana of more than 400 followers of Jim Jones, a case that I spent 3 years working on. So that's another, if it ain't broke, you don't fix it, I think. just too many investigations that interact. We got a tape that I'm hoping to play this year during movie night, if people want to hear it, of Dr. Martin Luther King, who I found out came to my university of Dayton in 1964 and did a talk urging nonviolence and the power of the ballot. And they recovered a tape of that. It's very moving to hear him speak. And as I said, there are other things that continue to come out on the other political assassinations, and I know that we had a presentation in the past by Jim Douglas at COPA about the Malcolm X assassination, which he's done work on and plans to write about in the future, along with, he just told me he's working on one on Gandhi's assassination in 1947. That's got important political overtones, and also on the assassination of Robert Kennedy and King, so he's got his work cut out for him. Another person that died this year that many of you knew is Walter Cronkite, called the most trusted man in America, but I remember him standing in Dealey Plaza in 1967, looking up at the window and saying, you know, it just doesn't seem possible. One man firing from one location could have done so much damage under ordinary circumstances. These were no ordinary circumstances. He was firing at the President of the United States. And thus the laws of physics suspend. Peter L. Scott's done a recent article on the CIA deceptions that are coming out through the Joan Eades case and the attempt to get those records, and that the House Select Committee and others were lied to, and people who were part of the plot were inserted into the investigation, unheard of course. But it's something when it makes the front page of the New York Times. Cyril Wecht, who will be talking with us later, finally got rid of his charges against him, although it bankrupted him, and they stole all of his investigative papers, those still haven't been given back. And it has nothing to do with what they're charging with, they took all of his assassination work, and he's really had a rough time of it for some years, and finally the woman that was after him, you know, has stepped down, and she was so bad. I mean, even Spector, excoriated her for saying afterwards that, you know, well, you know, this doesn't mean when he gets an acquittal, that doesn't mean he's not guilty. I don't know what you have to do to prove it. There was an article that came out through Secrecy News, which you should get if you don't, but the CIA did provide Bay of Pigs files to Nixon. I thought those were released to him. Another death this year, of course, of importance in the story is that of Senator Edward Kennedy, the final brother in the family. And, while some people may have different views about Edward Kennedy, he did support the JFK Records Act, and he did work to get those files loose. And many of the researchers feel that he was not the person responsible for the child quit against him, that he was set up. And Lieutenant General Victor Krulak died, who worked with Fletcher Prouty and knew Lansdale, and fairly high up in Air Force intelligence. And above him was, of course, my favorite person, General Curtis LeMay, smoking his cigar and smiling at the autopsy done at Kennedy. One of the spies died by the name of Rolf Kingsley, 91 years old, CIA grandee, they call him, revived the agency's troubled Soviet division in the late 60s after a paranoid-fueled mole hunt that defined morale. We're talking about James Angleton here. And he was OSS, the precursor of the CIA. He worked in the Middle East and Germany, joined the CIA in 47. Turkey and many other places, and he became a leading voice working to discredit Golitsyn in favor of a far more reliable defector named Yuri Ivanovich Nosenko. So he's gone, not without damage. This was an interesting one that I found. This is a socialite captivated and charmed. You probably can't see her from all the way back there. She has a nice little Easter hat on and some dolls next to her. And her name is Virginia Warren Daly, and she's popular, it says, with the opposite sex during her life. Ever since her best and beautiful, and she was the daughter of Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren. And who did she marry? John Charles Daly of What's My Line. It's a name Till Gallen ring about. Our old enemies are also still busy. But in strange places, I found an article called Spy Game Disrupts UFO Disclosure, and it's about Gus Russo writing about the UFOs, and also, guess who else, talking about certain types of new technology, Gordon Novell. Oh, yeah. And so they're busy in the UFO field, I guess, I don't know, what I call unrecognized fascist observatories. Alfred McCoy has been doing great work. He did a book on torture, and he has a new one out that I recommend called Policing Empire. And he's talking about counterintelligence innovations like centralized data, covert penetration, disinformation, developed during the Army's first protracted pacification campaign in a foreign land in the Philippines from 1898 to 1913, were repatriated to the United States during World War I, and became the blueprint for an invasive internal security apparatus that persisted for the next half century. So he's tracing it back to the counterinsurgency wars being brought home, and the loss of democracy here, the buildup of the tremendous surveillance, but he's also talking about the use of biometrics to help them identify people, and the joint expeditionary forensics facilities that are linked to a biometric database in West Virginia, so that a warfighter needs to know one of three things once they see the facial image of the enemy. Do I let him go, do I keep him, or do I shoot him on the spot? And a future is already imaginable in which a U.S. sniper could take a bead on the eyeball of a suspected terrorist, pause for a nanosecond to transmit the target's iris or retinal data via backpack-sized laboratory to a computer in West Virginia, and then, after instantaneous feedback, pull the trigger. And less, he says that seems fanciful. Bob Woodward said the success of the surge was less boots on the ground than bullets in the head, using this high-tech assassination capability. And they said that Woodward compared this to the Manhattan Project in World War II. One intelligence officer using these tools said that the program was so effective it gave him orgasms. And half a world away from Iraq and the southern Philippines, the CIA Special Forces of the U.S. did an early experiment to use with aerial surveillance for assassination and the beginnings of the drones that are being used now. So political assassination is not something in the distant past, it's something that we continue to carry out with new technology all the time. And Seymour Hersh, who I also invited to come and speak, although I don't like Dark Side of Camelot, because of his revelation of Cheney being involved in a current assassination squad, and he said I called him and he said he wanted to do more work before he spoke anymore. He shouldn't have talked so much already, I'm sure not. But he said that it won't matter. I said you could come another year, and he said it won't matter, there won't be a media in the United States in 5 years. And of course, one of the people that implemented that and also covered up the death of Pat Tillman was McChrystal, who's the new general that's in charge of the operations. He's a longtime black operations person in the assassination capability. And of course, one of the effects of decapitation, however it happens, of the executive or the congressional branches, is that it throws the country into emergencies and emergency laws and other things, which in fact we just went into recently when Mr. Obama declared a national emergency in relation to swine flu and the H1N1 virus. And that changes many federal laws and allows for many violations of civil liberties. It's not just to make sure that people get to the hospital on time. He worked actively with the Bush administration to develop the new thing that links pandemics to the installation of primary government and martial law. When he was in the Senate, he helped draft the legislation there. So, you know, an outbreak of a pandemic can lead to the same thing as a nuclear weapon now. And of course, you know that they continue to link anybody who believes that there's conspiracies in anything to everybody that believes anything, including, you know, we didn't go to the moon or Obama's not American or, you know, and whatever else they can come up with, or anybody that's just critical of the government or thinks that the government is not benign is now a conspiracy theorist. And, you know, they try to lump all this together in the articles, and they have psychology that we supposedly follow that, you know, it makes us feel better when we think that there are these powers in place that are killing everybody rather than the lone nuts just go out and do it, you know, because then it gives us a sense of purpose and a sense of reality. You know, if it was lone nuts, we'd be upset about the chaos that represented, and so this is a more comforting reality. I hate to tell you, but I don't fluff my pillow at night thinking that, you know, it's better to have a military-industrial complex kill Kennedy than Lee Harvey Oswald. I think it's worse, but lest you think I go about giving people nightmares because I'm a conspiracy theorist, I think my position is with nightmares. I think we study political assassinations in the end because they are done for a reason. And the reason is both social change and social control. And that's historic all the way back to Michael Ferrenti, one of our friends on the left, realizes this has been introducing his book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, outlines a much different history of Caesar becoming populist and moving in the direction that the people were pushing for, and that the patricians surrounded him and executed him for it, very similar to the Kennedy assassination. But Michael told me he's too old to travel, so he couldn't be here and do it with us. And recently, you may know that Oliver Stone was on the Bill Maher show, and he gave him a copy of the book we're going to be talking about tonight, Dead King, Unspeakable by Jim Douglas. And Stone wrote in a recent article, "The murder of President Kennedy was a seminal event for me and for millions of Americans. It changed the course of history. It was a crushing blow to our country and to millions of people around the world. It put an abrupt end to a period of misunderstood idealism, akin to the spirit of 1989 when the Soviet bloc began to thaw, and 2008 when our new American president was fairly elected. Today, more than 45 years later, profound doubts persist about how President Kennedy was killed and why. My film, JFK, was a metaphor for all those doubts, suspicions, and unanswered questions. Now, an extraordinary new book offers the best account I have read of this tragedy and its significance. That book is James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. It's a book that deserves the attention of all Americans. It is one of the rare books that, by helping us understand our history, has the power to change it. And the subtitle sums up Douglas's purpose, Why He Died and Why It Matters. It is a beautifully written and exhaustively researched treatment. Douglas lays out the motive for the Kennedy's assassination. Simply, he traces the process of steady conversion by Kennedy from his origins as a traditional cold warrior to his determination to pull the world back from the edge of destruction. Jim Douglas is an author. I know him somewhat also through the Catholic Workers Movement and his peace work over the years. His most recent book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, was published in April of 08 by Orbis Books. From 1963 to 65, he served as a theological advisor on questions of nuclear war and conscientious objection to Catholic bishops at the Second Vatican Council in Rome. I mean, it must have been a tough job then. He then taught theology at Bellarmine College, Louisville, Kentucky, the University of Hawaii, and the program for the study and practice of nonviolence at the University of Notre Dame. Jim and Shelley Douglas helped form Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action alongside the Trident Submarine Base in Seattle, Washington. He served a year and a half in jail for acts of civil disobedience at the Trident Base. Douglas is in Ground Zero, developed an inclusive community in 250 towns and villages and cities vigiling by the railroad tracks of the Trident nuclear weapons shipments. In September of 89, they moved to Birmingham, Alabama. From Birmingham, he's taken part in a series of peacemaking journeys to the Middle East and peace walks through Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan, and five visits to Iraq. In 93, Douglas was founded Mary's House, a Catholic Worker House of Hospitality in Birmingham, for homeless families, and he has also written four books on the theology of nonviolence, The Nonviolent Cross, Macmillan 68, Resistance and Contemplation, Doubleday in 72, Lightning, East to West, Crossroads 83, and Nonviolent Coming of God, Orbis 91. All four books have been republished by WIPF and Stock Publishers in Eugene, Oregon. So that's the distinguished guest we have to talk to us tonight, and we're glad that his